This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
In 1783, the newly formed American Congress promised to hang a portrait of a Spanish general who was instrumental in the colony's victory in the halls of Congress. Over 200 years later, it still hadn't happened. Then a couple of years ago, a young woman found out about that promise and took action.
You know, she went to the congressman, he went to her senator, he fight here and there, and finally the painting was hung there.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear about a new book for students that tells the story of how a young person with a purpose can make a difference. Then we'll hear about a young person who also made a difference in the New York State geometry regions. He found an error. We'll hear about people mapping out a way to bring geography back to the classroom, and we'll spend an academic minute flirting with disaster. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. If you were listing some of the great heroes of the American Revolutionary War, like you do, the name Bernardo de Galvez would probably not be near the top of your list, if it made the list at all. Well, it should. De Galvez was a Spanish general and the colonial governor of Spanish Louisiana during the Revolution, and was instrumental in helping drive the British from the South and funding Washington's army with supplies and soldiers. That's the story that Guillermo Fesser wants to tell in his new children's book, Getting to Know Bernardo de Galvez. Fesser's book tells the story of a young lady, subtly named Mary Activist, who works to get a portrait of de Galvez hung in the halls of Congress, something that was promised back in 1783. Guillermo Fesser is a radio journalist from Spain, now living in New York City. I asked why he wanted to tell the story of Bernardo de Galvez.
Well, you know, I've been in the States for almost 10 years, and I've been, you know, seeing a lot of, like, little independent dots on the map of the American history of Hispanic influence. But I always thought those dots are so isolated and nobody put them together, nobody connect them. And suddenly I found 2 years ago that somebody was working on trying to hang a painting on Capitol Hill about a Hispanic general who was helping Washington to win the Revolutionary War against the British. And I thought, what? I was searching that story as a journalist, and then I realized, yes, I mean, we have a general who spoke Spanish, who came from Spain, who have an army of Latin American people that was crucial to help Washington's back during that war. And I thought, we have to tell that story.
Let's get into just a little bit of the story. What was de Galvez's influence, and what did he do in the Revolution that made him extraordinary?
Well, you have to think that the 13 colonies, you know, when they decide to get independence, they didn't have an army. They have a lot of volunteers who were ready to fight, but they didn't have guns. They didn't have gun power. They didn't have uniforms. They didn't have money. So they needed help. And most of all, they were completely surrounded by the British. I mean, the North Canada was already British, and the South Florida was already British. The ocean, the Atlantic Ocean, was blockaded by the British Navy. So they were completely isolated. So they had to get a way to get the foreign aid that they needed, and the only way was the Mississippi River. And in the mouth of the Mississippi River was in New Orleans, and New Orleans at the time was the capital of something called New Spain. It was an immense territory who went up to Florida and up to Canada and down to Mexico. And so Washington asked the governor of Louisiana, of New Orleans, Bernardo de Galvez, to help him. And what he did, he opened the Mississippi River for the Patriots, and he put a lot of boats with uniforms that were made in Spain, with shoes, with blankets, with a lot of quinine, medicine from Peru that helped Washington to fight the malaria, and a lot of money. And they went all up the Mississippi River, up to the Ohio River, to what today is Pittsburgh, and it used to be Fort Pitt, and helped immensely, you know, to be able to fight the English.
This book is written for children. Why did you want to write a children's book about this figure?
Well, I think in life there's two things that I appreciate. One is learning, and one is having fun. If I'm only learning, I feel like, oh, my God, I should have some fun in life. But if I'm only having fun, I feel guilty, like I should be doing something useful. So when you combine these two and you learn something at the same time that you're having fun, then for me it's bingo. And I think that in school for children, when you present something that is interesting in a fun way, it'll be easier for them to, be interested in learning the story. And I thought this story is very interesting and very important to be in the school, because I have to tell Latino kids that they're not B citizens, that they belong here as much as anybody else. And I have to tell the kids who are not Latino that those Latino kids are not B citizens and they belong here as much as them. So in order to attract the kids, I have to do a funny story, an interesting story. So I decided to do it that way. So I think that was the perfect place. And maybe in 10, 15 years, I mean, those kids will make a difference in the way Latinos are treated in this country.
And the story in the book is a young lady trying to get De Galvez's portrait hung in the halls of Congress. And that actually did happen recently, didn't it?
Yeah, that happened in 2014, and that was the beginning of the whole story. That's what I was researching as a journalist, that the Continental Congress had promised, after the war was won, they promised that they want to hang up a portrait of Bernardo de Galvez where Congress meet, because they want to tribute the contribution of Spain and Galvez to the victory. So that promise was never actually accomplished, and this lady from Spain who was in Washington, D.C., read in the newspaper that somebody, a professor, had found in the archives that promise that never was accomplished. So he went, she went to the congressman, he went to her senator, he fought here and there, and finally the painting was hung there. So the book, yes, it's a story about an old hero from the Revolutionary War who spoke Spanish, and I think it's very important for everybody to know that we have a crucial contribution to the creation and the development of this country. But this book is about an actual hero that the kids can identify with, and it's a hero that lives right now in Washington, D.C., that did something only 2 years ago, and that shows the kids that, you don't like the way the world is, you can change it.
And in the end, President Obama made him an honorary U.S. citizen, didn't he?
Yeah, and it's an honor that only 8 people had through the whole history to have won them that, speaks Spanish and it's been done so much for this country. I mean, it's great. It's great that Latinos finally have a hero, a local hero, a hero from the United States, a hero with a blue passport, a hero who spoke Spanish. Because, it can bring the pride back and it can show a lot of people that, we have to be treated with respect. That's all we want.
When you write a book for school-aged children, how much do you have to balance the fun and the facts?
Well, you cannot mess around with the facts because it's history, so you don't want to manipulate history. But you don't want to give people a lot of data, too, because, it can be overwhelming, it can be boring. So what you try to do is to put people in the right trend. Just in case they like the story, they can find more about it. So what I did in my book, I did the essential facts that pretty much put the picture. But what I'm doing right now in the schools that are starting to use my book, I created a lot of digital tools. I'm putting together a website with a lot of material that kids can play and sing and do riddles in the school, and teachers can actually teach them while having fun. And my proposal for those kids is, like, I think there's many dots hidden in the history map of this country. Why don't you find, a dot in your local community? Maybe there's a restaurant that is, from Guatemala, or maybe you have, a party that nobody knows about it, or maybe you have a celebration every year that is related to something in Spanish, or maybe you have a local hero. So let's put the dots on the internet, on that website that I'm creating, and then hopefully, we'll have this drawing that we're looking for, and the drawing will shout loudly that Latinos belong here.
And again, the name of Guillermo Fesser's new book for students is Getting to Know Bernardo de Galvez. New York State has finally admitted they goofed, and a high school student was right about a mistake on the state's geometry regions. From station WBFO, Eileen Buckley reports.
A Suffolk County teenager discovered an error on the state's math region exam, but it took weeks for the New York State Education Department to admit the teen was right.
And I noticed one of the questions had no correct answer.
16-year-old Benjamin Caltelfo will be a junior this coming school year at Ward Melville High School on Long Island. Some consider Caltelfo a math whiz. When he was a seventh grader, he took the geometry regents. In fact, he's already taken almost every math course offered in his school district. Caltelfo tells us he discovered the math mistake on a question about triangles. He was reviewing the geometry test prep questions online because he was tutoring other students who were getting ready to take the regents this past June.
They had an example of angles side-side, which they're using to show that the triangles weren't similar, but it was an exception. I knew there was a mistake. I wrote up a proof that showed that the triangles had to be similar, and I showed it to my dad, who concurred, and Then we moved it on to Mr. Bernhard, who's the principal at the junior high school. And from there, he called the State Department.
I mean, I really am exceptionally proud that one of our own was able to take this little pebble, and the ripple effects that it had throughout the state is incredible. It's amazing.
Alan Baum is principal at the Melville High School. Baum tells WBFO News he was very disappointed at the response his student received from the state education department.
I thought they were terrible, denying Ben's expertise and knowledge base and failing to give him the appropriate credit at the time.
But Caltelfo put a petition on change.org to gather support for his finding.
They agreed to rescore the exam and the question.
Well, better late than never. The state agreed to give credit to any student who got that question wrong. So we are now at the tail end of our process of reviewing all of the Regents exams that our student has have taken and recalculating not only the Regents score, but the final course grade for those students that were initially adversely affected.
Mistakes on the Regents have happened before, and they have went unfixed. So initially, when they refused to correct it, I thought that would be the end of the story and that they won't change it. So I'm pretty happy that they did eventually come around and regrade the question.
He persevered, and that is what's going to carry Ben and our students so far in life.
Eileen Buckley, WBFO News.
Still to come, there's a push in some states to bring back geography education. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Americans are often stereotyped as not knowing much about the rest of the world. But according to the numbers, it's more than just a mere stereotype. In the latest National Geographic poll of geographic knowledge, American 18 to 24-year-olds place almost last, second only to Mexico. Educators say what seems to be a lack of interest in the world is really just a failure in teaching. Most of the world's industrialized nations require world geography through middle and high school. But here in the U.S., kids just take generic social studies. Geography is just another elective. Now, geographers, educators, and lawmakers are sounding the alarm that Americans cannot afford to live without a more solid knowledge of the world. The U.S. is a major global player, and more jobs than you'd think require you to know your maps. For the program Cross Currents, Hannah Baba reports.
This is a plotter. This is where we do large format printing.
Ashley Llewellyn and I are in a room with the most massive printer I have ever seen. The thing is like 10 feet long. She's a GIS specialist for an environmental engineering firm. GIS stands for Geographic Information Systems. While I wait, she prints a very large map she just designed. Then on the computer, she shows me a different map, this one of a plot of land up for redevelopment here in the Bay Area. She took soil samples on this site about a month ago, then turned her findings into a graphic layer on the map with markers to show where the soil's contaminated.
So you can see at 1 feet, these are all dark, right? So there's definite concentrations of petroleum hydrocarbons. And as we get
it's deeper, geography meets geology meets technology. Llewellyn is a geography grad and says her skill set is in demand. GIS specialists can make between $50,000 to $70,000 a year. For geoscientists, the median is $90,000 a year.
I owned a house before 30 on my own. It's more than livable, a more than livable wage. I have a very comfortable lifestyle.
Now, maybe Llewellyn's work sounds a little too specialized for you, but the work of geographers is everywhere.
Head south toward East Glen Street, then turn right onto East Glen Street.
Geographers map and design the GPS devices and apps we use every day. They work at companies like Google and Yahoo as GIS specialists. The military needs them for strategic planning. Commercial real estate planners hire them to decide where to build stores. Transportation departments, city and environmental planning departments, they all need geographers. But they're hard to find, because most U.S. schools don't seriously teach geography. Every state has some geography content standards, but only about 19 require them in middle school and only 6 in high school. California is not one of them. So at schools in this state, geography needs a champion.
My name is Lata Nigam.
At Mission Hills Middle School in Union City, that champion is teacher Lata Nigam. She says growing up in India,
geography was a subject that was taught at every grade level, starting 6th grade onwards, 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th, and 12th.
She found it strange that it wasn't taught in the U.S., so she decided to start teaching it herself.
Which present-day state, bordered by Montana to the north and South Dakota to the east, was the first to give women the right to vote in 1869?
Wyoming.
Boy, that was a quick answer, and you were right. Well done, sir.
We're in the multi-purpose room where 10 students, grade 5 through 8, are on a stage taking turns answering geography questions.
The Red River forms a border between Oklahoma and which state?
Today's the National Geographic Geography Bee, a yearly competition that tests kids on their geography knowledge.
Kansas?
Close, but no, the actual state is Texas.
103 California schools competed this year, including Mission Hills. Today's winner will go on to represent the school at the state finals.
The Skagerrak, a deep and narrow waterway, separates Norway from what peninsular country to the south?
Oof, that's a tough one.
Sweden.
No, that is incorrect. The answer is actually Denmark.
This is a private school. In many public schools, teachers don't always want to teach geography as a standalone subject because students aren't tested on it.
Under No Child Left Behind, the social sciences really took a beating because there was such a push for reading and math.
That's Natalie Wojcinski. She's a teacher consultant with the California Geographic Alliance, a group that works with National Geographic and advocates for geography education in schools. Wojcinski can sum up her feelings about this in 2 words.
Very frustrating.
She helps schools develop geography programs and argues it's part of basic literacy.
Everything can kind of flow from a study of geography. It's learning about society and politics, the environment, history, and the land that we live on and our planet.
In 2013, Wojcinski joined a group of geographers, educators, and lawmakers that lobbied Congress for geography education funding. It got some support, but not enough to keep it alive. Geography teacher Lata Nigam says geography needs a makeover. She says it should be part of the STEM curriculums that are so popular now, science, technology, engineering, and math. That's how students will get those GIS jobs.
Learning about mountains, you know, valleys, even learning about glacial topography, space, how the roads are made, statistics, planning, earthquakes, volcanoes, whether it's topography, you know, planets. I don't know why they don't think of it as a science, because it is a science.
This idea is catching on. More and more schools are teaching GIS, high-tech mapping and data analysis. Leading GIS software maker Ezra donated $1 billion of mapping software to schools nationwide. And a company called Zombie-Based Learning created a curriculum to, quote, bring geography back from the dead, using a graphic novel about a zombie apocalypse. California Geographic Alliance's Wojcinski says a science and technology makeover for geography is fine, but she worries that something important will be lost: human geography, learning about people and their cultures.
My hope would be that students would view themselves more as citizens of the world. And I don't want to lose that at the expense of saying it's STEM.
Let's go back and check in on the Mission Hills Middle School Geography Bee. After a grueling hour, there are two students left. Time for the final deciding question.
And the last question, National Geographic explorer Shivani Bala works with warriors in the local Samburu community to protect lions south of Lake Turkana. In which African country?
The crowd sits very still. The first student guesses Tanzania. It's wrong. The second student...
You guess Kenya? Kenya is correct? So, Isaiah, you are the school geography bee winner.
Eighth grader Isaiah Bayardo moves on to the next level to compete with more than 100 students from around the state. He says he doesn't know yet what he wants to study in college, but he likes geography a lot. And the way things are going, maybe it'll be something he can do for his career.
And that report from Hannah Babba first aired on the KALW program Cross Currents. With the latest rush of hurricanes hitting the U.S., being prepared for a disaster is more important than ever. And that's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Disaster preparedness is often lacking. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Peter Neil Peregrine, professor of anthropology and museum studies at Lawrence University, examines whether greater local governance and political participation promotes more resilience after a catastrophe.
Hurricane Katrina prompted the disaster prevention and management community to rethink established practices and to recommend that local participation in disaster planning should be increased. Humans have faced disasters like Katrina throughout our history, and the past can provide examples of both effective and ineffective mechanisms of disaster management. I tested whether greater political participation promoted resilience among a sample of 33 ancient societies that had experienced catastrophic climate-related disasters. The time depth archaeological data provides allowed me to test whether those societies that proved more resilient to climate-related disasters actually had greater political participation before the disaster struck. In other words, archaeological data allowed a way to empirically test this predicted causal relationship. In addition, because I looked at societies from all parts of the globe and from differing time periods, my results should be broadly generalizable to most human societies, including our own. This has great potential for developing effective disaster prevention and management policies. What I found supported the prediction. Societies that encouraged political participation were more resilient to catastrophic climate-related disasters than those that did not. Encouraging political participation provides greater flexibility in decision-making, allows communication and response to occur at appropriate scales, and gives the entire response system a broader range of knowledge to guide decisions. My results suggest that those seeking to make our society more resilient to the climate-related disasters expected in the next century should work to promote policies that increase political participation, empower local governance, and include input from citizens across all social groups.
That was Peter Neil Peregrine of Lawrence University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at @TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.